Hi, welcome to this week's program. In the 35 years I've worked as a financial planner, I fielded a lot of questions about retirement and heard a lot of angst about the right and wrong ways to plan for and manage the money side of it. Today, I want to address three of the most common mistakes and misunderstandings that I see retirees make, often with painful results. It's one of those situations where you can benefit from other people's mistakes, and, you know, boy, there's nothing as good as benefiting from other people's mistakes. So I hope that you can store the general ideas away in your memory and bring them up later in conversation, perhaps with your financial advisor. The first mistake has to do with electing to receive Social Security benefits too early. Did you know that if you opt to receive Social Security benefits in the first year, you can receive them at age 62, and that your monthly benefits will be as much as 30% smaller than they would be if you waited to collect at full retirement ages, which is around 66 or 67, depending on your birth year? Or that if you delay your Social Security benefits until 3 or 4 years after full retirement age, you'll see your benefits grow by 32%. The longer you wait to apply for Social Security benefits, the higher your monthly checks will be. Not only that, but the differences can be pretty dramatic. You'll receive nearly twice as much per month if you wait until you turn 70 than if you start at age 62. That's some pretty powerful stuff and important numbers for you. If you've already made the decision to receive Social Security benefits early or even at full retirement age, you may be able to back out. You may be able to put your checks on hold and wait until the benefit amount gets larger. Those who have been receiving benefits for less than a year can withdraw their application for those early benefits and reapply later. In this scenario, you pay all the benefits you've already received back to Social Security. The process is pretty simple, but it does get a little more complicated for those who have reached full retirement age and have automatically begun receiving benefits. You can suspend the monthly checks for up to 4 years or until age 70. For each year you do this, there's an 8% bump in the amount you'll receive when that suspension comes off. An important side note is, for both of these scenarios, is that spousal and survivor benefits will also be suspended while your benefits are being delayed. So that's an important consideration. I've done a number of segments on this issue. Just come to our website, stevepomerantz.com, and then put in Social Security in the search bar, and you'll see a lot of great segments on this. Knowing exactly when to start and how to claim Social Security benefits can be, as one expert put it on fool.com, diabolically complicated. This is especially true when children are in the equation and you'll need to grapple with family benefits. It's generally a good idea to seek professional advice when it comes to figuring out Social Security benefits and how that should fit within your overall retirement plans. Now, the second mistake people make is investing too conservatively during retirement. This one can be a little tricky because conventional wisdom suggests that as you get older, you should shift the assets around in your retirement portfolio from riskier investments like stocks to less risky investments like bonds. Now, many early retirees try to do too much of this rebalancing too quickly. So they pull most of their money out of equities and put it into conservative, lower return assets in search of wealth preservation. Considering the traumatic losses that investors were dealt during 2008 and the dot-com market meltdowns, it's no wonder that retirees are eager to cut back on their stock holdings and coast on money markets, bonds, and fixed annuities. The problem is that they forget that retirement could last 30 years. Simply put, to enjoy financial comfort for 2+ decades of retirement, you may need a higher rate of return on your savings during retirement than what pure conservative investments can really provide, especially these days with bond interest rates being so low. And these low returns can hurt your standard of living when you think about the effects of inflation. Rising prices will continually eat away at the purchasing power of your savings. So yes, even though inflation has been low for more than a decade, the interest rates on bonds, CDs, and money market funds and savings accounts have been even lower. So your standard of living is slowly shrinking year after year. This all leads to the thought about whether or not your money will last throughout your lifetime. Under this low return scenario, many will wonder if their money will last their lifetime. It's a very real possibility and one that shouldn't be neglected. You don't want to find yourself relying entirely on Social Security. As a matter of fact, recently I did a segment entitled The Gray Nomads about people who are down basically to just living on Social Security and getting odd jobs. Not a really a great way to spend your final retirement years. So, even if you only have a modest amount of money to work with, you should consider investing in stocks or some real estate so you may grow what's left. You should also do your best to be financially prepared for unknown hardships and expenses, particularly health care and possibly needing assisted living care or long-term in-home care later in life. And here's the last mistake. This is a mistake that I see retirees make continually, and that is they want to immediately pay off their mortgage. Now, I realize, though, that there's a powerful psychological appeal to being debt-free. But in reality, many people at or near retirement should consider not accelerating the payment of their mortgage. You know, I should note the reasons I'll list here do not apply to everyone, and you should try to get professional advice on your unique situation before making a decision to pay or not to pay off your mortgage. One compelling reason to hold off on retiring your mortgage is if you have credit card debt at much higher interest rates. Pay these and other high interest loans off first. If you're still working and haven't contributed to the maximum amount to your IRA or 401k accounts, prioritize these over paying more towards your mortgage. On a related note, if your mortgage interest rate is relatively low, it's probably wise to divert funds from paying it off into investments in a diversified asset portfolio. Of course, this does involve taking on new risks, so you ought to compare your mortgage rate to a risk-free investment like a good quality bond. If the mortgage rate is higher, you may actually want to pay more towards the mortgage in this case. Also, if you plan on moving out of your home in a year or two, it's better not to pay off your mortgage. Finally, and this is something I see a lot and it's very important, if you have modest amount of savings, don't use the bulk of it to pay off your mortgage. You might need it for emergencies, and you might need it to grow so you can accumulate more wealth. Remember, you do not want to be house poor. There are quite a few tax and other issues that I can't cover today, but a certified financial planner and tax accountant should be able to walk you through them. Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Once upon a time, there were a few well-regarded online sources for reliable financial information and advice. But in recent years, with the explosion of the internet, we now have nearly unlimited information at our fingertips. Now, it is possible to find good financial information, but it takes a little knowledge and it takes a little skill. And we're going to give you some of those today. My guest is Eric Tyson. He's the author of Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s for Dummies, and he writes regularly about these issues. Hey, Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Steve.
You know, in the early years of the computer, I was, you know, totally absorbed, and we would go to the bookstore, my wife and I, and I would be in the computer section, and it would be a computer for dummies, and then the next time I would go, I'd be looking and buying computer for idiots. And then I was in there one time, and my wife said, "What are you looking for now? Computer for morons?" So we're not in the moron territory, but we are definitely in the dummies territory. So, you know, in seconds flat these days, we can look up anything we want to know about money management. And that's good news and bad news, right?
Well, exactly. And I think this younger generation, you know, to whom this latest book of mine is particularly targeted, I think are especially prone to that because they've grown up, you know, with cell phones in their hands and access to computers all around them. And they're used to typing things into a Google search and expecting that they can get an answer to something in less than a minute.
Right. So there's information, though, that you should ignore and even run away from. And then there's information that actually is of quality. But how does a person who's not steeped in the knowledge of investing or finances tell the difference?
Well, yeah, and that is the key question. And part of the answer to that question is to get educated yourself because, you know, as I've long argued, you can't possibly evaluate the quality of information and the competence of a person that you're seeking advice from if you yourself are completely ignorant on a topic. So, you know, person doesn't have to become a full expert, but you need to learn enough so that you can evaluate the quality of the information that's out there. And that, you know, and that's where, you know, books like mine and programs like yours can help individual investors.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So the book is Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s for Dummies. I'm talking with Eric Tyson, the author. So let's get to some of the things to be aware of. We're going to teach today, and we're going to help our listeners be able to discern to some degree the difference between the bad and the good. So the first point that you have for us is consider the hidden cost of a free website. Take us there.
Well, exactly. I mean, we don't have to look any further than the recent scandal and problems with Facebook to understand this problem is, you know, people should be suspicious any time they go to a website and there's lots of seemingly free information. Well, that should raise the question in your mind, well, how are the purveyors of this website actually making money?
Right.
And therein lies, you know, a whole host of potential problems for you, the web surfer.
So you got to kind of figure it out. Is it advertising? What are some of the other ways that these free websites, quote unquote, make their money?
Well, the so-called referral or affiliate fees are a big problem on these free websites. And for example, you might be wanting to get advice on, suppose you've heard about credit cards, all these reward cards, you want to get free travel on airlines and free stays in hotels. So you may go to some websites that have articles on the topic, and then you click on a link, and before you know it, you're taken to an application form for a particular credit card. Well, that right there is a potential red flag because a lot of these websites that have such articles are getting affiliate fees, typically in the neighborhood of $100 a pop every time somebody clicks on a link and actually, you know, fills out one of those credit card applications.
You know, years ago, I owned a website, MedicareBenefits.com, and the model was to have very good quality articles, objective articles. Everything that we do here is objective. And then when they click through to, you know, one of the internet, e-insurance or something like that, where they could then have a choice of their, you know, their healthcare plans. And that was how we structured it to make money.
Sure.
So would you consider that a negative way to go about it? Or is it just a question of you as a consumer knowing what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, it's not inherently problematic. And, you know, ultimately it comes down to, you know, and in the example that I gave with the credit card links, it's not necessarily bad. I mean, it could end up taking you to a good card that does actually meet your needs. But what I guess what I have a problem with is that consumers are largely ignorant to this going on, and the disclosure, for my taste, on too many websites is really inadequate. you know, I think the disclosure arrangement should be made clearer on a lot of websites.
Yeah, and plus a lot of websites will create content that kind of gets your adrenaline going or gets you agitated in some way looking for a short-term solution. And that's one of the things that you mentioned in the book is that, you know, be wary of the short-term focus and addictive nature encouraged by many websites.
That's exactly right. You know, and you also hit the nail on the head with, you know, talking about, you know, so-called provocative content where, the, you know, they're going to unnecessarily, you know, raise your anxieties and concerns. And in the field of personal finance and investing, it's easy to do that. You know, you can start talking about how, you know, the stock market may be on the verge of a huge crash.
Always. Yeah.
You know, and a certain website may claim that, you know, not only have we predicted, you know, things like this happening in the past, but, you know, we've perfectly positioned our investors in exactly the right vehicles. You know, when you start to hear that kind of terminology or claims of ridiculous return numbers, there should be major red flags. But yeah, also be careful about any website that, you know, is providing constantly updated content that is addictive and that gets you coming back and feeling like you need to check on things constantly. You know, sound personal financial management, sound investment management, and I know you agree with this, should not be done that way. You should be able to set up a good portfolio, a good financial plan, and not have to be checking on it every minute of every day.
Well, you know, buying investments or making investments, let's say in stocks or in companies, is really an investment in companies. If you bought a dry cleaner down the street, you wouldn't be trying to figure out what the value of that dry cleaner is every 2 minutes.
Exactly.
You know, you would look at earnings and you would try to forecast, you know, the future of that and hold on to it if it's doing well, not what the stock price is doing at any moment. You know, earlier we broached the point that, you know, a lot of consumers don't really have the knowledge to be able to discern between good advice and bad advice. And that's why, you know, a lot of these sites that have message boards where everybody's got an opinion, you know, I always look at those and I go, well, how do I, you know, I mean, maybe what you're saying sounds somewhat reasonable, but who the heck are you? You know, how do I know that you're valid?
Well, exactly. And, you know, people come up with these, you know, cutesy sounding screen names that obfuscate their identity. You know, and a lot of times, you know, the people who are, you know, posting on these message boards, they either don't know what they're talking about or even worse, you know, they may be extremely biased or have enormous conflicts of interest, which they're not disclosing. You know, maybe you've heard about these cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and you go onto some message board to learn about a particular currency. And it turns out that a lot of the people who are posting on that board are people who actually work for that particular cryptocurrency company. So, you know, those things are not obvious or disclosed, and you really have to, you know, it's like, would you go down the street and just strike up a conversation to ask advice on investments? Well, that's basically what you're doing on a message board. And again, I'm not saying that you can't find out something potentially useful, but more often than not, the information and opinions that are posted on there are not worth anything.
I mean, there are some sites. There's a site by the name of Seeking Alpha, which has gotten a lot better over the years. People are required to say whether they have positions in the stock.
Mm-hmm.
They tell, you know, if they're financial professionals and the like. And you still have to be very wary because an opinion is just an opinion. You've actually just got to go in there and do the homework and figure out or find an advisor or a manager that knows how to do that for you and team up with that person. But some way you've got to get inside the knowledge circle and get a level of competence in that area. Hey, Eric, unfortunately, we are out of time. My guest is Eric Tyson. You know, Eric is a best-selling personal finance author, counselor, and writer. He's the author of 5 national best-selling financial books, Investing for Dummies, Personal Finance for Dummies, Home Buying Kit for Dummies. So I guess Eric is the king of the dummies. So I hate to leave it that way. But Eric, thank you so, so much for taking your time. And if you have a question that we just discussed, you know, ask us. Go to stevepomerantz.com. Ask anything you'd like at stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update, and we'll send you the weekly commentaries and interviews straight to your inbox. Eric Tyson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. My pleasure.
listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. Many people wait until the new year and the annual ritual of New Year's resolutions to take stock of their finances. But there are compelling reasons to attend to some financial tasks before December 31st. Sandra Block joins me to discuss some strategies to start 2019 in a better financial state. She's senior editor of Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Hey, Sandra. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with some end-of-year steps we can take to save taxes, take advantage of certain programs, or fix our portfolios before end of the year. And I think the first thing you say is don't wait until 2019 to implement some New Year's resolutions. There's compelling reasons to attend to some of these financial tasks before December 31st. Let's talk about the first one. If you work and have an FSA, you should spend that money, right?
That's right. You know, flexible spending accounts have a use it or lose it provision, which basically means if you committed to put a certain amount of money into your account at the beginning of the year, you either have to spend it by the end of the year or some companies will let you carry over $500 through the first quarter of the next year. But basically, if you don't spend that money by the deadline, you will forfeit. You'll give it back to the company. And it's usually not that hard to find things to spend the money on, because the list of things that you can use these accounts for is pretty broad.
Yeah, and the idea is if you didn't use it officially, you can reimburse yourself for a lot of these expenses like eyeglasses, dental care, and so on, right? So there's kind of a list that you can go through and say, hey, what was medically related? What can I reimburse myself with?
That's right. And as I said, the list is really broad, and I've done this myself. I've walked into a drugstore with the list. And, you know, because I knew I had money left over, even things like contact lens solution qualify certain non-prescription drugs. And certainly anyone who has contact lenses, you can, you know, stock up on those for the next year. So there are any last minute dental expenses. So just don't waste that money because it's your money.
Yeah,
and
right.
It is a good thing to have because it's tax advantaged. It basically lowers your out-of-pocket costs, but you don't want to give it away.
Now, there is a plan available by most employers and insurance companies that is not an FSA, which is flexible spending account, but an HSA, a health savings account, and they are very different. How are they different?
Well, these are actually, we're pretty high on these because as more and more people are either ending up in a high deductible health insurance plan, either by choice or by necessity, because that's all that their employer offers. A health savings account offers a way to contribute pre-tax money towards the same types of expenses that an FSA will cover. The advantage is the money rolls over. You don't have to spend that money by the end of the year. You can carry it over. You can even build up a large balance so you have that money there for perhaps a major medical bill or your medical bills in retirement. So I think if you have an HSA, you definitely, you know, you want to use that money for things, but you don't have to. And now that it's open enrollment season, if you are in a high deductible plan, you should definitely consider setting one up. You can't have both. You can't have a flexible spending account and a health savings account. But I think if you're in a high deductible plan, a health savings account is the better choice.
Well, you can put $3,450 into an HSA if you're single, up to $6,900 if you have family coverage. If you're over 55, you can make an additional $1,000 contribution. So let's just use that for a second. Let's say you can afford to put in $4,450. And let's say that you can also afford not to use it, to kind of save it for the future and pay your current expenses currently. You know, 4 or 5 years, what are you talking about? You know, $20,000 sitting in this plan for you for your retirement for the future. And it's all, you got a tax deduction for it. And if you get it invested properly, and if it does grow, all the earnings are tax free as long as you start to use it appropriately for medical expenses. So it's a kind of a really great deal.
It is a good deal. It's what we call it, a triple tax advantage, because as you said, you don't get taxed the money you put in, you don't get taxed on any earnings that you earn, and you don't get taxed on the money you take out as long as it's used for qualified expenses. And I think what we're seeing more and more is people recommending just what you said, go ahead and pay your expenses out of pocket, let that account grow. When you retire, you can use it for all kinds of retirement-related medical expenses. And as we know, healthcare is a huge expense in retirement, so it's nice to have this pot of money there for you when you need it.
We're going to do one more healthcare-related idea here. This is making sure, if you can, that you qualify for the healthcare subsidy in 2019. We're talking about kind of Obamacare. We're talking about the fact that if you make under certain thresholds of income, the government will help to pay your premium.
Yeah, the most important thing I would say here is to see if you qualify for the subsidy. And one of the things that we recommend is there are certain things you can do to your income that will lower it. You know, don't take out, if you're retired, for example, you know, monitor the amount that you withdraw from your pre-tax plans and things like that. Because from my own experience in talking to people who have signed up for Obamacare, the difference between buying a plan with a subsidy and without a subsidy is huge.
Yeah.
The subsidy literally can lower your premiums to a few hundred dollars a month versus several thousand dollars a month if you don't qualify. So I think it's really important to look at things. And actually, this late in the game, it might be hard to do that. But the subsidized plans are very affordable. The unsubsidized plans can be really expensive. Now, that may be all that you have. You know, it still may be less expensive than buying a plan on the open market.
Yeah, but still, look, if the government's going to pay the lion's share and you're at those thresholds, which, by the way, for single is around $49,000. For couples, it's $65,000. These are levels of income over which you don't get the subsidy, under which you do. And then for a family of four, it's $100,000. I think the idea here is to take stock of what your income is going to be. And if there's anything that you planned on doing that would create more income for you in this year, you may want to delay it, like taking capital gains or taking a distribution from an IRA, because that'll push you over the threshold level. So that's, we're just telling you to be smart about this. Think this through, because you don't want to go into 2019 and say, I should have done it.
Right. And you don't want to go into 2019 without health insurance either. And I think what people may be missing, because they're not publicizing these exchanges anymore very much, is that, as you said, if you qualify with the subsidy, the plan can be quite affordable and it covers a lot. You know, it's not like some of these older plans that had all these, you know, things that they didn't cover. These plans are required to cover, you know, a good amount of anything that you need. So I hate to see people go without health insurance. This is still an option for people who don't have a plan through their employer, and people should definitely look into it and see if they qualify.
Okay, Mom, I heard you. We'll do. So let's talk about different kinds of money that you can take care of. But let's talk about your credit cards. You know, looking at the end of the year, you may have accumulated some credit card rewards. I personally like having a cash back card, and I try to find the card with the highest cash back. And I like that. I get a nice amount of money at year end, or I save it for vacations. What are some of the other rewards that you should take a look at and maybe spend this year rather than next?
Well, a lot of, and I'm guilty, you know, we hear from readers all the time who are like you, who really keep track of their rewards and have cashback cards and are just very vigilant about making sure that they're getting the most. And then there are a lot of people who I would say like me, who have a credit card that does offer rewards that just sort of quietly accumulate and you kind of forget about them because you're not really focused on that's why you have a credit card.
Yeah.
So what I would say is go to your credit card's website, go to the loyalty link or the redeem your rewards link and see what you have. I mean, I know what I've done in the past is one of the things I can use my rewards for is an Amazon gift card. Mm-hmm. So I can cash in my rewards, get a gift card, and use that gift card to buy people gifts for Christmas.
Yeah.
So I think it is a good idea to look at all of your credit cards and see what rewards may have been quietly building up that you might be able to use. I think sometimes if you're not really playing this game, the rewards may be disappointing. Like they'll throw all these things in there that you might be able to buy, but then you look at how much points you have and you're not there.
Yeah.
But if you can get a few gift cards, maybe get a discount on a hotel or a rental car or something like that, you know, why not take advantage of it, especially this time of year when people spend so much money?
Some of the cards offer, let's say, a savings for travel, maybe free baggage and other things like that. And some of them are based on a calendar year rather than a year based upon your adoption of the card. And if it's a calendar year and we're talking about December, that would be the time to kind of get a new card that has a calendar year rewards option so you can kind of capture that by the end of December and then, you know, get a double benefit, basically.
Yeah, that's a great strategy. And the other thing I would do, say, especially for travelers, is just review and see what perks your card offers. A lot of times people don't realize that their card, as you said, might offer free baggage check-in. Some of them have concierge services. You read the fine print, sometimes you find out things, and certainly for if you're renting a car, you know, it may cover your insurance. So I think it's a really good idea to look and see, as you said, what points you have that you might be able to use, whether you could open a new card and capture some new points, mm-hmm. or just see what services your card offers that you may not have been paying attention
to. Okay, so we're really telling a story of paying attention, right, and focusing in very, very laser-like on this year-end thing and how can you take advantage of all these things. One last thing that I talked a lot of my clients about and really anybody who listen is that when you're saving money, there are different savings rates available all over the country, different kinds of banks. And to just have your money sitting in a bank that's paying you, you know, fractions of 1% these days, it's just wrong. And it's up to you, the consumer, to start shopping around. So, you know, some money market savings types rates where you can get your money at any time, some of the rates are as high as 2.25%, right?
That's right, because interest rates have been rising. But banks often are very slow to respond to rising interest rates, particularly if you have your money in a traditional bank. They just aren't going to jump on it. They have so much cash that they're not having to pay interest on, and it's just not in their interest to raise rates. But
right.
If you look at some of these online banks, they are very competitive. They, as you said, are offering 2% or more. And this is on your cash. This is on money that maybe
right.
hasn't been earning anything for years. So I think that's one of the most effective ways to earn more money with no risk. You know, if it's FDIC covered, you don't have to worry about losing anything. It's just a matter of going to the trouble. I think banks really count on inertia. They
yeah.
count on people not paying attention
yeah.
to this.
Yes.
And as a result, people have billions of dollars sitting right. in accounts that aren't earning anything at all.
Right. Okay, everybody. So pay attention to your stuff. And this is a good one here. You know, $100,000 at 2.25%, that's $2,250 at the end of the year. Keeping pace with inflation as opposed to some fractional return of 0.25%, which is like $250 a year. That's $2,000 extra in your pocket for what? Doing nothing, transferring your money from one bank to another. My guest, Sandra Block, senior editor for Kiplinger Magazine. And don't forget to hear this and all of our interviews. And if you have a question about anything that we've discussed, we love to hear from you and we love to answer any question financial that you may have. So contact us. Go to our website at stevepomerantz.com. And of course, while you're there, sign up for our weekly update. This is where we'll send you the show into your inbox. You can choose a particular segment that you want to hear or listen to the whole show. We have transcripts. We have summaries available. Everything to make it very easy for you to access and to get the most out of your money. Sandra Block, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Let's, you know, it's kind of a year end and we like to look ahead. We,
yep.
We do that in the market and we say, what a stock's going to look like next year and so on, bonds. What are the fearless forecasts for real estate in 2019?
Well, according to Realtor.com, rising interest rates and home prices are going to make it more difficult for buyers and sellers, or challenges.
All right, well, tell me something I don't know.
I know. You asked the question. I'm reading the answer.
All right.
You know what?
Yeah.
We're going to see modest inventory gains.
Okay. You're actually seeing some of that now
absolutely.
In your own practice. Tell us about that.
So basically, well, my inventory level has doubled, so to me, that's an early sign.
Meaning what? Your listings have gone up?
The number of listings that I've taken.
So how many listings do you generally have on average?
On average, that aren't pending or
kind of
under contract. Normal, I'd say 12.
12. And so how many do you have now?
25.
So there's a huge bump there. Something's going on.
So, yeah, I would say, you know, real estate is local, so you always have to, because a lot of the things that we talk about are national,
yeah, of course.
Regional,
mm-hmm.
and then it really, what's going on in your little world, that hyper-local.
Okay, but let me ask a specific question then. These people that are listing with you, are they doing it for the typical reasons they're moving, they're downsizing, or is anybody saying to you, you know, we feel like the market's topping out here, we've been waiting?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because I question that myself and I ask people, and everyone has a reason. And honestly, I took like a dozen listings in the last couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So of those, all a variety of answers.
Okay.
Downsizing, some people are upsizing. Mostly the trend that I saw was downsizing, which
yeah.
concurs with the information that we had researched,
yeah,
you know, to do the radio show this week,
yeah,
we're seeing people looking to downsize.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's always those first-time home buyers, and there's a ton of them looking to
purchase. Think millennials are playing a much more important role now in the purchasing side of things.
Absolutely. But yeah, I'd say for the most part, it was predominantly downsizing.
Okay. So according to Realtor.com, home price growth will continue to slow, and they're forecasting it an increase of only 2.2%.
Right. So that's a retraction of price gain. This is not a complete shift from a seller's market to a buyer's market, which some people perceive, you know, I'm hearing people chat about it. I've seen different newspaper articles. It takes a little time for that to really happen, but it has to retract first. And that's what we're seeing. You're going to see an increase of inventory, which we're seeing, and you're going to start to see prices retract.
So let's say there's positive growth and then there's negative growth.
Right.
You know, that's an oxymoron. But the idea here is that the rate of growth is decelerating.
That's right. And this is actually really healthy for the real estate market.
Yes, it is.
We need this.
Yeah.
You know, we were praying for more inventory as agents, and now we're getting it.
Yeah, that's right. Well,
but we're never happy.
Yeah, I know you're never happy. I know. Homes are somewhat less affordable. There's going to be this transition period. But the bottom line is, if prices keep rising well above the economic case that can be made for affordability,
right,
then you're entering into bubble territory,
right,
and then bad things will happen after.
Exactly.
That.
So this is very, very healthy. This is a good thing. It's a welcome.
A welcome thing. It also says here that millennials will account for 45% of mortgages in 2019 versus 70% for boomers. So the boomers are, I guess they're kind of taking their money, or they've accumulated money. They're not taking on as many mortgages. And now millennials are coming in behind them and doing kind of the normal
millennial
American
thing,
you know? Well, they're forming families, and the families are growing, and they need
exactly.
more room.
Exactly. Getting a mortgage has gotten a lot easier. We have not swung to the crazy days of, you know, you have a pulse, you get a mortgage, but we are seeing loosening up of the restrictions on
obtaining
a finance.
Yeah, we've talked about that. It's easier. Yeah. Now, we have all expected interest rates to rise. Last week, the Federal Reserve Chairman Powell announced that basically they're going to cool it a little bit on the rising, but those are short-term rates. The market itself, the mortgage market, is based kind of on the 10-year treasury.
Right.
So that rate has actually come down. It's approaching 3% now.
The interest rates were pulled back a little
bit,
too. So
this idea that interest rates are screaming forward and going much higher, much faster, basically that idea did not play out. It's stopped in its tracks, and actually rates are coming down a little bit now. So that's good.
It's all healthy.
It's all healthy.
It's welcome the change.
You know, I know you love people who buy and you love people who sell.
Love all people that do anything with real estate.
And if you've got more listings and it's more affordable to buyers, that's a beautiful thing.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Win-win for everyone.
Okay, good. All right, let's change gears here and talk about my favorite segment, which is the Real Estate Survival Guide. And Gary Singer from the Sun Sentinel post these questions and answers, and we love to read them. So here's one. I inherited a house. What do I do now? Aretha Franklin died without a will, leaving an $80 million fortune in multiple properties. Although Franklin's sons appointed her niece to be executor of the estate, the situation shows how family feuds and other problems can potentially result when inheritance portions aren't clearly defined or when an executor may be in over their head. So let's talk about some decisions that the family has to make and an executor might face.
Right.
So do you keep it, do you rent it, or do you sell it?
I see this all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's see more family feuds.
I know, it's tough.
It's really, really, really tough. And the key is you've got to remove the emotions from it. You have to make sound, rational decisions based on facts.
You know, if you're in a healthy market, selling is probably a good idea because it liquidates it to cash. Cash can be evenly distributed. People can then go their own way.
Yep.
Medical bills can be paid. All the debts can be tied up and everything. If you keep it, it's got problems because now you have to maintain it. You have to rent it. You have to have someone there who's responsible for managing the properties.
And you all have to share in that expense.
And you have to share in that expense. And that can get kind of
dicey. It can get very dicey if other family members aren't financially capable of doing that.
What if one family member wants to buy it? You better get a proper evaluation.
Right.
Right? That's an appraisal.
get an appraisal by two appraisers.
Everybody's
going to
get really mad at you.
Calculate the average.
That's for sure.
Yep.
And do you repair? Do you renovate? Do you keep it furnished or unfurnished, depending upon what was in there to begin with? All of these issues are very, very tricky to deal with. So if you find yourself in this situation, make sure that, you know, you've got a good guide, someone who's real estate experienced, and a good financial advisor to help guide you through that.
Absolutely.
All right. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. Today, in a world in which news flashes around the globe in an instant, time lags are inconceivable. In the mid-19th century, communication between the United States and Europe, which was the center of world affairs back then, was only as quick as the fastest ship could cross the Atlantic, making the United States isolated and vulnerable. But in 1866, the old and new worlds were united by the successful laying of a cable across the Atlantic. My guest is John Steele Gordon, who has written many books chronicling the growth of America, The Scarlet Woman of Wall Street, A History of Wall Street in the 1860s, Hamilton's Blessing, The Extraordinary Life and Times of Our National Debt, The Great Game, The Emergence of Wall Street as a World Power, 1653 to 2000, and A Thread Across the Ocean, The Heroic Story of the Transatlantic Cable. Now, I read A Thread a few years ago, and it seems I'm going through a phase of understanding the historical context of our world today. And John Steele Gordon's book chronicles this extraordinary achievement that changed our world forever. And I have him on the show with me right now. Welcome, John.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
John, is a great book, and I've now just recently reread it. And again, it holds up really quite well. What was the state of communications between the old world and the new?
Well, they have been improving throughout the 19th century. In the 1800, a ship could, the average time going from America to England was about 6 weeks, and going the other way was about 8 weeks. But if the weather was really lousy, it could be 3 months. By the middle of the 19th century, they had steamships, and the time frame was going down and down and down. By the 1860s, it was about 10 days for the fastest ship.
So all of the news that was happening in Europe, any wars or volcanoes like Krakatoa and so on, nobody really knew about that for quite a long period of time, correct?
Yes, and it could be 2 weeks before you heard some big news that happened in Europe.
You know, you wrote in your book that when people came to the United States, they basically had to stay here. There was really no going back, except for a few business people and elites. Traveling back and forth between the old and new world was literally impossible. So what was the kind of person, and this is rhetorical, I have to ask myself, what was the kind of person that would make that one-way trip, knowing not what faced them in the new world at this early period of time in our country's history, but the fact that this was basically it, almost all ties to the old world were cut. And there was this tremendous desire now to try to bring the two worlds together. Now, a lot of things were happening both in England and in the United States in the early 1800s. New England was going through a tremendous upsurge in manufacturing in the Industrial Revolution. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Industrial Revolution began in England in the middle of the 18th century. Historians are forever arguing about exactly when. It's not very important, which is why they argue about it. In the United States, the Industrial Revolution began very early in the 19th century with cotton mills in New England, where they had quickly flowing rivers that could power it. And that became a very big industry, and that it was growing quickly in the United States, but England was still by far the industrial powerhouse of the world.
Mm-hmm. And they were expanding their own empire to faraway you know, lands and climes and so on, right? So England reached how far?
England reached around the world. I mean, it was literally true that the sun never sets on the British Empire. It was the biggest empire in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm. Also, we were starting to create electricity through the use of steam and other technologies, which started to improve manufacturing of cotton and other things as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, the steam engine was what really powered the Industrial Revolution, because it was the first new form of work doing energy since the windmill, which was invented in the 7th century AD. Here was, you know, you turn a low value energy, heat, into something that can move things. And it transformed the world and rapidly developed a new kinds of steam. I mean, the Watt steam engine was obsolescent by early 19th century. So they had a new kind of steam engine called often called a puffer engine, because it exhausted the steam in both the upstroke and the downstroke. Mm-hmm. So it made a puff, 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 puff noise, and that was powerful enough to move railroads. And that meant that you could move freight overland mm-hmm. cheaply and quickly.
Right.
And that was a big revolution.
It was also the harnessing of electricity at that point in time. I mean, we all know about Benjamin Franklin and the kite experiment with the key. And, you know, electricity was discovered early on. It was not understood early on, but this idea that you could actually move electricity through a cable was important, or through a wire was important. Tell us about that.
Well, indeed, at that time, electricity was not well understood, although we understood much better by the 1840s than we had in Franklin's day.
Yeah.
But we knew that, you know, it could be transmitted long distances down a wire, and the trick was to find a way to use that as a signal. And it was Samuel Morse who, you know, there were lots of people, they were one in England and stuff, but Morse came up with the Morse code, mm-hmm. which was a marvelously simple way to transmit information through a wire. And, you know, once you learn Morse code, if you're good at it, you can interpret it by ear.
Mm-hmm.
And so good, you know, trained telegraphers would simply, they listen to the Morse code and just write it down. And so this could move information. And it started 1844 from the Capitol building in Washington. He telegraphed to his partner up in Baltimore, "What hath God wrought?"
Mm-hmm.
And it then took over. By the 1850s, telegraph lines were reaching all the way down to New Orleans and up into Canada and what have you, and of course also in England and Europe.
So these were overland wires in which the electricity traveled pretty easily, very fast. And there was a lot of talk about trying to lay some underground or underwater cable in order to bridge straits and, you know, small seas and other things. And that was actually happening on the European continent by this point, right?
Yes. Well, they wanted to lay a cable under the English Channel.
Mm-hmm.
So that's only about 25 miles or even less than that. And actually, the first time they did it, a French fisherman accidentally caught it in his net and pulled it up and didn't have any idea what it was. So he cut a piece out to take home and show people. And that was the end of that cable. But pretty soon it was working. And then it was Cyrus Field who said, you know, boy, that's a great idea. Why don't we lay a cable across the Atlantic Ocean? And he said later that if he had known anything about it, he would never have started because it was sort of like, you know, somebody reading about Sputnik in 1957 and saying, hey, let's send a manned expedition to Mars.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just an order of magnitude more complex and probably two orders of magnitude more expensive.
Cyrus Field is the main protagonist in the story. Who was he?
Cyrus Field came from a remarkable New England family. One of his brothers, Stephen Field, sat on the U.S. Supreme Court. Another was David Dudley Field, who was probably the greatest lawyer of the 19th century and wrote the Field Code of Civil Procedure,
mm-hmm.
which is now used around the whole English-speaking world.
Right.
And so Cyrus Field went into business, and he became a paper manufacturer and made a fortune. And, you know, he was one of those people who always had to be doing something new. Once the paper company was up and running and throwing off money, just running it was boring.
Yeah.
And so he went to South America with a great artist. Sorry, I just can't think of his name off the top of my head. And then he read about the cable and he said, let's do that. And he started and he was, you know, once he got the bit in his teeth, he just wouldn't stop until he succeeded. Frederick Church is the artist.
Yeah. There's a quote in your book that he had the desire to own the means of instant communication, which I thought sounds like a very modern phrase. this idea of instant communication. He wanted to be the first, and, you know, he obviously, there were many drivers, but not the least of which was to continue to build his fortune. So he basically put together a consortium of pretty well-known people at the time. I know Samuel Morse was involved on his board or in this initial group. Peter Cooper, who formed the Cooper Union, if you know of New York, you'll know the Cooper Union. It's actually where Lincoln spoke and basically became noticed by the world after the Cooper Union speech. Who else was involved in this consortium that we may or may not be familiar with?
There were a bunch of New York businessmen, most of whose names are now pretty much forgotten. There was the head of the Citibank. Mm. There was the head of one of the gas companies that was supplying, you know, gas for lighting. People like that, their names are now no longer, you know, in current use. But they were a group of the richest men in New York, which meant they were the richest men in the country.
So what were the difficulties? I mean, there were numerous attempts. Let's talk about the first attempt. Seemed very naive looking back at this thing. What was the cable made up of? How did they insulate the cable? I mean, there's all these considerations. And really, how did they roll the cable out through all of this 2,500 miles they were trying to cover?
Well, the first cable was very badly designed because they didn't know how to design it. It was a steep learning curve to climb here. It was heavy in terms of its volume. And what it was a strands of copper wound around each other. And then insulation, there was iron used to, you know, armor the cable. And then it was insulated with a stuff called gutta percha, which came from a tree in Asia. Basically, it's a kind of plastic. Mm-hmm. And it was used for lots of things. It would harden, and they used it to make walking sticks. And they also discovered that it made much better golf balls. And so, and it was, you know, it was basically the first plastic. It came from a tree. It wasn't, you know, created chemically, mm-hmm. but still it was functionally a plastic.
The quality of the ships back then also were a problem as well, right?
Well, they simply weren't big enough. There was no ship in the world that could carry 2,500 miles of cable. And so the British used one of their warships, and we used the Niagara, which was one of America's biggest and best warships. And the original theory was that the British would start in Ireland, and we would start in Newfoundland, and we'd meet in the Atlantic and splice the two together.
The first attempt, there was a lot of celebrating, a lot of newspaper accolades, but it was an utter failure, right?
Yes, they got about 400 miles and dropped the cable, and they couldn't find it again, and that was the end of that. Yeah.
Cable broke, 400 miles of cable irretrievably lost.
Yeah, and so they did it the next year.
Yeah, okay.
They tried again the next year, and this time they decided to, you know, start in Ireland and go to the mid-Atlantic, and then they would meet up, splice the cable there, then continue to Newfoundland. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they ran into a horrendous storm, and both ships barely survived.
Right.
And so they had to abandon them. The next year, in 1858, they actually succeeded in getting the cable across to Newfoundland. And Newfoundland had already been connected by telegraph from Nova Scotia across what's known as the Cabot Strait at the entrance to the St. Lawrence River. And so once they got to Newfoundland, then they were connected to the American telegraph network, and mm-hmm. everything was supposed to be fine. And they had a huge celebration, had a big parade up Broadway. They set off fireworks from New York City Hall, burnt the cupola on the top of City Hall, and they almost lost the whole building. And Queen Victoria sent a message to President Buchanan. It was 99 words, and it took 16 hours to transmit.
Which they didn't tell anybody. They didn't tell anybody that they were having problems transmitting. They just said it's working, and the Queen Victoria message actually got across. But actually, what happened then?
Well, what happened was they kept having to repeat it. I mean, basically, the guy at the other end kept saying, what? You know, retransmit.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was just barely detectable. And then after about 10 days, the cable just stopped. You know, it was dead as a doornail.
All this celebration, all of this, the newspaper accolades, and then it stopped. And then actually everything just turned against the whole plan. There were claims of fraud. Cyrus Field was scorned. And yet, he said, we'll do it once again.
One thing is very important. This is 1858. This is in 1857, there had been the Great Indian Mutiny had broken out, the greatest crisis of British India in the 19th century. But by 1858, it was winding down, and a regiment that was stationed in Canada had been ordered to India. And during that 10-day time frame when the cable was still working, Britain was able to send a message to Canada saying, don't send that regiment. We don't need it. And thereby saving about £300,000, which is a lot of money in the mid-19th century. So Britain realized the extreme utility of undersea cables because they had a worldwide empire to run. You know, we needed it just because we'd like to get the latest news from Europe more quickly, but Britain needed it to run their empire. And so they were willing to continue. And what they did actually was they sat down and figured out what had gone wrong. What have they done wrong? So they won't make the same mistake again. This is how we've done this ever since. Just like when an airplane crashes, we go to a great deal of trouble to figure out exactly why that plane crashed and how can we stop another such accident happening again. That's what they did this time. And it greatly improved. They also got help from a man named William Thompson, who was a professor of physics in Scotland, and he later became Lord Kelvin. The Kelvin scale of temperature is named for him.
Yep.
He was one of the greatest physicists of the 19th century, and he helped design a new cable that was, it was fatter around, but it was lighter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it came closer to floating than the old one had, which was very important, made it less likely to break.
This is a great story. Unfortunately, we're out of time. The final part of this story is that there was substantial success in 1866, and money transactions were now being equalized between London and New York, and there were two worlds that were starting to come together. My guest is John Steele Gordon. The book is A Thread Across the Ocean, The Heroic Story of the Transatlantic Cable. And if you have a question about what we just discussed, ask us. Go to stevepomerantz.com. Ask us anything you'd like at stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update where we will send you the weekly commentaries and interviews straight to your inbox. John Gordon, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.